You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guest this week is Prentice Howe.
I think it's really defined more by a mindset. They have ambitions that outweigh their internal marketing resources. They have to outthink. They can't outspend. But I don't think it's just about chasing number one in the category. These are brands that are really bringing good to the world. They're migrating culture. They're turning predictability inside out.
Prentice has always believed in underdogs. Now, as owner and chief creative officer of Door Number 3, a full-service advertising agency based in Austin, Texas, he's helping brands embrace their challenger ability and topple their giants. Specializing in challenger brands, rising brands that may not have the resources of the top dogs in their industries, but do have the bold ambition to go toe-to-toe with them and steal market share, Door Number 3 is changing the face of marketing and advertising with features in the New York Times, Adweeks, The Wall Street Journal, Inc., and Communication Arts, as well as recognition from shows like Cannes Lions and the Webby Awards. Prentice has written the book on the challenger space. Literally. An Amazon bestseller, The Empowered Challenger Playbook, How Brands Can Change the Game, Steal Market Share, and Topple Giants, describes his strategies in detail and backs them up with case studies. It helps that Prentice practices what he preaches. He has firewalked on hot coals at a Tony Robbins event, for one, a feat he credits for shaping his mind over matter outlook. In 2015, he made another bold move when he bought Door Number 3 from its founder and his friend, M.P. Mueller. Having spent 7 years as its executive creative director earlier in his career, he knew the agency inside and out. As a creative person, buying the company from a friend, he knew the risks too. In fact, Door Number 3 is now one of the few agencies in the country solely owned by a creative. Prentice, welcome to On Brand.
Hey, Nick, thank you for having me.
Well, there's so many things I love in that bio. I don't know where to start, but I will say that last part you talked about being solely owned by a creative, it is a challenge. Usually, I was reading that and I was thinking, now why is that so? And then I remembered that most of the time you come up with this dynamic duo in agencies, and it's usually pretty easy to spot them by appearance, in that there's kind of the creative person who, as my vocal inflection implied, usually dresses and is easy to spot. And then there's the button-down business type that you might not see as much, but that is keeping the trains running on time. But you either have multi-pass personalities or you've mastered both of those types.
Oh, gosh. I don't think mastered is the right word. But yeah, I think, you know, one day you got to wear the ironic T-shirt or wear the denim on denim. And then the other day, yeah, you got to look pretty spiffy and be the account person. No, it's just something you grow into, I think, as you're in the business for a while. I definitely came up on the creative side, but have learned to adapt.
Well, it's interesting. I would put myself in that category as well. I've had various partnerships through the years, and it was a little scary at first saying, okay, I'm going to do that. My initial gut was to outsource all of that, but was thankfully pointed in the right direction by the most buttoned down of all advisors, my accountant, that said, you really should know where all of that is going. So That was great advice,
Well, that is good advice. Yeah, I mean, you gotta learn all that stuff. But there's also benefit to understanding your weaknesses or things that someone else could help you with or do better than you. So that there's always some good in doing that as well.
Well, I maintain in a somewhat self-supporting way that it reinforces my own worldview. But I kind of think that the combination of grounded creativity is important, because in everything that we do, there is a business reason behind it that we have to understand if we're going to have a real impact.
Yeah. No, you're so right about that. It's funny. I grew up in creative departments at different agencies around the country, and my background is as a copywriter. So when I started in this business, it was always, you know, trying to write the funny headline, or, you know, when you present the work early on, it's just, well, it's cool. It's buzzy. People would love this work. And it's fun to see how the business has evolved in the 2 decades plus that I've been in it. And it's not about being buzzy or fun always, although that's important. It's got to be grounded in solving a business problem. So that's funny, because that's something I often tell writers, is you're a writer, but your real job is to solve a business problem. And so, you're right about all that.
Well, I sort of think it's what really separates the cream of the crop, the wheat from the chaff, is that, I think it's also why our business lends itself to so many people kind of armchair quarterbacking. Oh, that's great. That's a funny Super Bowl ad or something. Mm-hmm. But there's all these things that can be, you know, nutty and creative just for the sake of being creative. But to understand and diagnose that need and come up with a creative solution is really what's a lot more complex and going on behind the scenes. And so many of the creative for the sake of creative are things that you remember because they might have been funny in a moment, but you can't really connect them back to sometimes even who the business was that ran the ad.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's just perfect. It just feels so good when you can kind of overlay that story with science, and there's it's grounded in the truth, it's grounded in the strategy. I mean, but it's memorable and different. But it's got to do both. It's got to work on both levels to be successful, for a client to be happy, to see the return on the spend, and for them to keep working with you.
Well, and I think that's especially important when we talk about challenger brands, which I love being, I feel like this interview with you is all a backdoor into things that support my own worldview. But having written another book on that worldview as well, my first book, Get Scrappy, I'm all about that underdog mindset, and it's interesting because I don't know about you, but I had some publisher pushback on what the underdog mindset is, like who the audience is, because I think there's a snap judgment that leads some to believe, oh, it's marketing on the cheap, it's small business. And I was talking with the folks at Schwinn, the bicycle company, and they said, yes, this idea of the scrappy underdog, because they said we could all use a few people and a few dollars more. I encounter larger businesses that think of themselves like Schwinn as underdogs. Do you find that the underdog isn't always what you think it is?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, you can get challengers or startups that, you know, have identify with that, and but they have no money or very, very little money. And that's not enough. I mean, I guess there's a couple ways. I think you're bringing up a good topic. One is I'll cite how Adweek would define a challenger, because they recently did that in 2019. And they said it's defined as an up and coming company that use data-informed creativity and entrepreneurial strategies to disrupt the status quo. So that's a good start. And I think that describes it pretty well. I think it's really defined more by a mindset and an ethos than really a pecking order. They have ambitions that outweigh their internal marketing resources. They have to outthink. They can't outspend. But I don't think it's just about chasing number one in the category. These are brands that are really bringing good to the world. They're migrating culture. They're turning predictability inside out. They're doing something that's changing the game. And of course, I think competition for them goes beyond just competitors. You know, when we look at a challenger, the obstacles like company culture or processes or customer service or product offering are sometimes more detrimental and need to be actually fixed first. So I think everything needs to be considered when you're a challenger. But these are the ones, you know, the ones we work with. They cannot spend that of the category leader, but they know that they have to spend and invest a higher percentage of gross revenue than an equal sized company with less growth ambition, so if that makes sense. So I think there absolutely you have to be scrappy and you have to figure out how to outthink, but it unfortunately, no, it doesn't mean you can get away with not spending anything. I mean, you have to invest in the right way.
That was the huge disconnect is that I had to kind of prevent them from making my book into marketing on the cheap. And yeah, it's exactly what you said. You have to figure out a way to actually do more with less. And you talk about challengers. That is a heck of a challenge. But there's a lot of thinking to kind of harken back to our earlier point of kind of some of the eating of the vegetables that we have to do, not just creative for creative sake, that has to underlie what we're working on.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, most of the companies we work with are probably 20 million plus revenue companies. But oftentimes they need to shed bad practices or just kind of commit to a new philosophy of marketing with the goal of being differentiated and disruptive and getting really, really hyper-focused on doing one or a few things well and staying committed to that.
Would you like to see the On Brand podcast on stage at South by Southwest in Austin next March? I've put together a special live episode on how to build a VR brand with Amber Osborne of Doghead Simulations and Joanna Popper of HP. But I need your help. Please head to the South by Southwest panel picker and search for On Brand Podcast to find our submission. We'd love a quick upvote and a comment letting us know how excited you are about this submission. Or you can head to onbrandpodcast.com and find a link to vote there. Big Texas size thank you from me. Now, back to the show.
So, who is one of your favorite examples of a challenger brand that fits kind of your adapted definition from Adweek as to who's really whose logo would be in the dictionary if we looked up challenger brand?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you could go big and say, you know, VRBO or Uber or Tesla, and those are Amazon early on. Those are all kind of probably obvious. They've grown into, you know, I think they still operate with a good challenger ethos, but it's hard to, you know, they're so big now. On a smaller scale, I mean, there's companies like Favor. I look at Thinx. I don't know if you know Thinx. They're out of New York. They're period panties. Yes. So that might make some people uncomfortable, but it doesn't make their audience uncomfortable. So it's a whole new way to deal with the menstrual cycle. But you know, they're totally challenging a category, and they're doing it because, I mean, I look at a brand like that. They're really a lightning rod, but they're doing it in a way that product differentiation, beautiful, really smart storytelling, and then the voice is just, and these are things that are a must-have for a challenger. Then the voice is just, it's not marketing speak, it's not marketing fluff, it's just, it sounds like a friend talking to you, and I think that works for them big time.
Well, that's an interesting point too with Thinx. I would love to, if anyone's listening, would love to have someone from Thinx on the podcast, but it reminds me of some of these things that we think of as conversational taboos that are almost the products that need to be talked about the most. Like you said, it's like the voice that they found is like talking to a friend, and that is really what you're looking for in that space. I'm reminded of kind of someone else that I think has grown beyond that, but still operates with that that challenger mindset that you were talking about, is Poopery. I was able to interview their founder, Susie Batiste, on the podcast here. And in the same way, it was one of those things that people didn't want to talk about, but they've made conversational.
Everybody poops, right?
That's exactly. I know. And yet that's... They've even published a book with that in the title, but that's still a scary thing to admit for some reason.
That makes me think, not that we want to stay on this topic, but it makes me think of, you know, the founder of Thinx started Tushy, which is bidet attachments. They're really transforming health and hygiene, and, you know, no big deal to Europeans, but the U.S. market, that's kind of taboo and weird, right? But, I mean, they go so far as to If you go to their website, you can see branded T-shirts that say, ask me about my butthole. So, I mean, you know, it's just and not that all challengers have to have this polarizing, crazy voice. That's not the case at all. I mean, but I think what it is just be unabashed and true to what you're selling and your audience. And you just can't be safe. And safe is different, and appetite for risk is different for different companies and products. But it's just something that you just have to keep in mind. Every dollar you spend has got to be maximized.
Well, you talk about safe, and I think a lot of different people have said it, but I always attribute it back to Seth Godin, because, you know, the opposite of good and bad aren't the these polar opposites. It's this kind of average, this safe in the middle, that if you are spending money on creative, on marketing, on strategy, and if where you end up hitting is right in the middle of the road, that is not the optimal middle of the bell curve where you'd want to be sitting.
Isn't that funny? I mean, there's a writer that I love working with. I'll credit him, Eric. He said to me, he said something about, you know, what is safe work? You know, there's nothing safe about doing mediocre, bland wallpaper work that people may or may not notice. Like, that's actually the riskiest thing you can do, you know, versus pushing it and saying something meaningful and maybe pushing away some but attracting others better. You know, it's just what's the definition of that? But it's got to be looked at.
Yeah, yeah, and if we're not doing that, and I think that the folks that we're working with a lot of time, they want their money to be safe, and I think sometimes that's a disconnect between our business in marketing strategy and in execution, creative work, and the clients that we're working with. This is mm-hmm. their money. Please be a judicious steward of it. And
sure,
that sometimes is a hard case to make. And I think we don't always make that case as effectively as we can, as effectively as Eric just pointed out in your story there, that we can't. It seems incongruent. It seems counterintuitive. But what we can't do is aim for the safe.
Right. Yeah. No, it's always going to be some mix of art and science. So you have to keep that in mind. But I think you can be convincing in terms of, once you really understand your audience and how they want to be spoken to, you can be convincing when you have the opportunity to work in digital and test messages, and, you know, you can put things up and take things down. And, you know, it's not like everything's a printed brochure that is being handed out to 50,000 people anymore. So there's ways to do it that mitigates risk a little bit.
So you talked about, as before we got to Thinks, you talked about Uber, Tesla, some of those that are great examples that you might look up. And it's easy to forget that these brands that we talk about constantly now are really challenger brands. They have risen to become something much bigger. But at the core, at the end of the day, that's how they got here and really why they matter. I think an interesting turn to navigate is where some of those brands are at. How do you preserve that challenger mindset when you might not be exactly a scrappy upstart anymore?
I that's a commitment to kind of maintaining a challenger ethos, right? It gets harder. I think it gets harder and harder as you get to be a behemoth, no doubt. And it may be that there's some that are able to maintain that by having part of their product offering, part of their company, kind of continue to be out front and act in that way. But you got to continue to behave that way in some form or fashion, because we can quickly forget, like an Uber or a Tesla, like as much as they're part of our lives now, they haven't been around that long, right? No. I mean, they're still fairly young companies, but they just scaled so quickly. So it becomes, what you're identifying becomes a real challenge to just maintain it. And know that if you don't do it, there's going to be people nipping at your heels that are going to be of that mindset. So, you know, I think in a case like Tesla or something, they're never going to have a problem with that, because they've got someone at the helm that embodies it. And, you know, most really successful challenger brands that have grown up and scaled like that, there's someone at the top that is that persona, you know, that's who they are. And that's not going to go away. But if that starts to dissipate, or if it's if there are committees or if there's a board that's, you know, decisions being made by someone other than that kind of original heretical thinker, it's challenged for sure.
Well, you mentioned this earlier as well, and kind of ticking off some of the more important aspects of a challenger brand and of that mindset and the different ways of standing out. I think in those examples too, in Uber, in Tesla, that some of the challenges, the growing pains, are really around how culture has changed as the business has scaled too. How And that's, I talk about all these turns that we sometimes miss with the brand. And I think that culture is so important in standout brands. But as you reach this inflection point of growth, it's sometimes tricky to navigate that and making sure that our culture doesn't become something else as we scale and we end up disconnected from the brand, from the ethos that we are.
Right. Yeah, yeah, it's probably healthy to stop and pause and evaluate that at least every year and take a look at that, because that can be shifting sands that would make you want to change your roadmap.
Well, talk a little bit about that roadmap, because I think especially as you're talking about launching a challenger brand, as you're talking about launching a new campaign, what are some of the points of reevaluation that are natural? Because I think sometimes we launch these great big things and maybe we aren't going back in for a checkup quite as much as we should be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the big thing, and this may be obvious to some, but it's amazing how many overlook it or move past it too quickly, is just the critical importance of positioning. I know that's a really big word, but you know, what do you offer that others don't, that your customers want and need? And being able to say that probably in 12 words or less and have that be the communication filter for everything that goes out the door on behalf of the brand or the product. And just, you know, there's brands that have continue to reevaluate that and look at it and make sure that they're staying true to it year after year. I think of like a Southwest Airlines, you know, I mean, their new campaign, Transparency, is just, that's a really smart, disruptive way to talk about an industry that is, you know, not serving its customers like it should be. But this is also a company, Southwest, that's been around for a long time now, right? And they disrupted when they started. So I think they're continuing to be really smart about stopping, pausing, and making sure the positioning is locked and it continues to differentiate. Because if, you know, I think we all know, but I mean, if you're not differentiated at the beginning, you certainly will never have the opportunity to be fascinating, and you'll never have the opportunity to be consistent around that message, and you'll never get to advocacy. So that's the biggest thing, I think, Nick, that we work with clients on in this space. And it just seems like a table stakes kind of thing that, yeah. It's amazing how many companies come to us and feel that they're positioned. And I will say, yeah, no, you're really not. You're not.
Well, and the mark of something good is something that can be iterative, like that Southwest story, that a brand that is built on customer care and looking at an industry going through some major growing pains. The idea of transparency, alluding to transparency, customer transparency, which is more important than ever before, that puts that customer care message into a context of today. It still passes that 12 words or less. Yep. My Eric story is a friend of mine, Dave, who's in politics. He's actually in the state house here, and you know, we get a lot of presidential candidates in our neck of the woods. This time of, I won't say time of year, but time of year every 4 years, and we were talking about some of the different candidates, and one of his kind of like you said, table stakes for some. He said, "What's the bumper sticker?" And that was his alluding to the 12 words or less. And I think that that transcends politics. I mean, I think sometimes politics are great proving grounds for some of these brand strategies, because they have to happen so fast. But I think a lot of us, you know, whether it's the bumper sticker, whether it's your 12 words or less, would fall short of your point that you made of, oh, yeah, we're positioned.
Yeah, right. Right. No, you're right. It's in politics. It's not just in advertising and marketing. It's everywhere. It's critical. And I look at Southwest and I love when transparency to me is such a positive way to bump up against something. And I think challengers that are really doing well, they do it in a way that's emphatic and positive, and there's an air of optimism. They're still bumping up or pushing up against something. They're still kind of calling out the negative. So when they say transparency, I know what they're talking about. I mean, it's like, how many times have you gone onto a website to purchase a ticket and you get this great deal, and then you go through checkout and you realize you have to pay for the seat and the bag and seat assignment, and when you get on, you're gonna have to pay for some water and your peanuts, and it's just, yeah, it goes on and on. So there's a way for brands to do and challenge bigger behemoths, those that are outspending, in a way that I think I just love it when they can do it in just a optimistic way, but it still pushes up against something.
And another super important thing to say about that is transparency is a good turn of the phrase. And the important thing I think to note about transparency is that it's a clever turn of the phrase. It's maybe something that wouldn't be that hard to come up with, but I think one of the most important points about it is Southwest can say that because that's who they are. I don't want to mudsling it at other airlines, but if United said that, I think people might raise an eyebrow.
Yeah. Yeah, and this, no, you're right. And this may, on the heels of that, this may sound completely obvious, but we get a lot of clients where we have to come in and do rescue and recovery on messaging because they're kind of up in the clouds talking about things that are just... you could slap a different logo on and it might work for another product in their category. So, I mean, the best thing you can do as a challenger with not as much to spend as the big guys is to really look within, stand in front of the mirror naked and be like, what do we have here? And mine the best of what you have. And it's got to be super true to you. And I mean, I love the phrases. I think about one that we worked on, it was Mighty Swell, which is a wine spritzer, comes in a can. You find it in the beer and wine aisle. And that's an example of a challenger where, you could do something about fruit forward flavor or taste or something that would be really good and funny or different, but maybe not different enough, maybe blend into all the other spritzers out there. And the campaign that we did was, let's celebrate. So we would find funny contextually relevant reasons to call out a reason to celebrate, like at the grocery store on the cart, didn't get a wobbly wheel. Let's celebrate. Advertisements said he vacuumed. Let's celebrate. Didn't wear yoga pants 3 days in a row. Let's celebrate. There's life is hard, but making a decision around which spritzer to pick up and take on the boat for the weekend shouldn't be. So what I love about working on challenger brands is being able to work with my team and find something that's inherently true to who they are and bring that out, rather than just have this kind of general message that could kind of blend in with anyone else in the category.
That is great. And I love the idea of message recovery. So very important.
Yeah, that's right.
As we start to wrap up, we've talked about a few examples, and I've loved a lot of them, but what's another brand that has made you smile recently?
Oh, smile. I feel like I'm talking about all the ones that are a little bit edgy. Maybe that's okay, because there's a lot of great challengers out there that that are doing – they're challenging ideals and disrupting without necessarily, pull my finger jokes. You don't have to do that. But since you asked, you said, what makes me smile? And I'm going to say Bird Dogs. I don't know if you know Bird Dogs, but they're the gym shorts for men, birddogs.com. So they're just so on point with who their audience is and how to talk to their audience. If you get their emails or read any of their web copy, I'm looking at right now on their website, there's a question that says, what are bird dogs like? And there's a quote says, from, I guess their accountant, which says, I filed Bird Dogs taxes last year. They blew $10,000 on a live baboon to recreate the Lion King because they wanted to, quote, get it right. And so they're real just funny and self-deprecating and just crazy and fun. But I just appreciate a brand like that can just know their audience and speak to it. And I call that fostering rejection, which is like pushing away the masses in order to attract your most ardent fans. That's what you have to do. That's what you have to do to build advocacy and be like, you know what? We're not the freaking Cheesecake Factory. We're not for everyone. You can't get wonton soup, lasagna, or pizza on our menu. We do this. We do one thing. We do it really well. And we're speaking to you.
Wow, that is a great distillation of everything that we talked about of fostering rejection, that we have to get over the idea of playing it safe. Prentice, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, we're on the internet. So
the internet?
We're there.
Make note of that. I need to follow up.
I know, yeah. We're on the dark web. You can go to dn3austin.com is our website. I'm on LinkedIn, just first name, last name, Prentice Howe. I'm on Instagram too. Same thing, same name. So yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. So
awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Prentice, thanks for being on brand with us.
Thanks, Nick. I love your show, and thank you for having me on.
And as a reminder, you can find show notes, links, and more at onbrandpodcast.com. If you like what you're hearing, remember to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you like to listen. And please take a moment and rate and review the podcast to help others find the show. For more on me, including how you can sign up for my newsletter, please visit nickwestergaard.com. That's Westergaard with two A's. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.